still only four men. From the comfort of CIA Station Kabul, Berenson realized he couldn't appreciate the pressures or conditions the men were facing. "I'm sorry, get some rest. Help's on the way. We'll have an SF team, Special Forces, there in less than 48 hours. "That's great news. We'll be back up on the air in 6 hours. Juliet, forward out." The team was so played out, they were unaware of the approach of the village chieftain they'd met days earlier. Their security, provided by Babrak, had quit 2 days prior, leaving the Americans entirely alone. The chieftain, clad in sandals and Afghan man jammies, the ubiquitous outfit worn by Afghan and Arab males that to Westerners resembled a calf-length dress, walked up on their position in the snow without warning. His purpose? Having watched the utter destruction of the mountainous valley during a continuous inferno of smoke and earth-shaking explosions, one after another, he had traveled to thank the Americans for killing the Arabs. "If he'd been Al-Qaeda, we'd all have been dead," recalls Joe, adding, "If Al-Qaeda had even sent out patrols to find out how the Americans were targeting them, we'd have been wiped out." But Al-Qaeda never caught on to how the new game was being played. The other team was the ODA provided by Colonel Mulholland, with CCT Bill White attached, now in position on a ridge on the opposite side of the valley from Joe. After a single 6-hour break, Joe and the team stayed up 65 of the next 72 hours, moving ever closer toward the most hardened Al-Qaeda fighters and their leader. When Bill showed up with the Green Berets and occupied a location across the valley from Joe, the two controllers began coordinating from their different OPs, dividing the terrain and aircraft to keep the pressure on. Because Al-Qaeda was communicating on open radio frequencies, CIA SIGINT collectors were getting real-time intelligence on the impact the airstrikes were having. "We're getting B-52s dropping 45 MK-82, 500-pound unguided bombs, in a single pass. All this within a couple kilometers square. It was unbelievable." From December 3rd to 8th, Joe O'Keefe, a single CCT, controlled and cleared 688,000 pounds of bombs in the Malawa Valley of the White Mountains, a record that still stands for tonnage dropped by a single CCT or anyone else during an engagement in the history of airborne warfare. The exhausted men, out of food, out of batteries, were exfilled by the CIA on the 8th and returned to the Jalalabad safe house, knowing they'd killed hundreds of hardened fighters, but not having destroyed bin Laden. The CIA had pinpointed the Al-Qaeda leader's transmitter only 1.8 kilometers in front of VB2, but that was as close as the ill-equipped team got. "I was spent. No food. No water, but it was Adrenaline City," recalled the first CCT to directly target UBL. He would not be the last. More help was at hand. Delta Force had been forwarded by JSOC Commander Del Daly to enter the fight and kill bin Laden. 40 Delta operators, led by a young officer by the name of Tom Greer and accompanied by Mike Stockdale, a 2-4 CCT and teammate of O'Keefe's, arrived as the Jawbreaker team pulled out. Footnote: Stockdale is known as the Admiral inside Delta Force for his name's resemblance to the Vietnam Naval Medal of Honor recipients. All Delta Force operators use a personalized call sign to identify themselves. Tom Greer, the team leader, was Redfly, and would go on to write the story of Delta's and Stockdale's Tora Bora mission in the book Kill Bin Laden, under the pseudonym Dalton Fury. The Delta A Squadron Sergeant Major, also there to lead the mission, was a man whose inexhaustible courage, resilience, and leadership on the Tora Bora mission remain legend in Delta. His Delta call sign? Ironhead. The names are bestowed by group consensus and not chosen by the individual. Mike Stockdale was relatively junior at the 2-4 in the fall of 2001. A Denver native, he graduated from the 2-4's green team in 1998. Unlike O'Keefe, he'd been in Hungary on a JSOC exercise at the time of 9/11. After returning home with the majority of the command's staff and operational units, he'd quick-turned and found himself on strip alert as part of a CSAR, combat search and rescue package, in Turkey, where nothing exciting happened. He got his break when Delta's A squadron needed another CCT, and he found himself on an MC-130 Talon to Bagram, where he met up with A squadron Sergeant Major Ironhead and his new immediate commander, Tom Greer, known by all as Redfly. Tall, thin, with weathered eyes, brown hair, and an easy disposition, Mike already had a reputation as unflappable inside Delta, but this was his first opportunity to go to war with them. He was met by another CCT, Sean Gleffy, who outranked him, but when Greer pushed farther north to Jalalabad with his 40-man contingent, and from there to Georgia's forward stage jawbreaker position, Gleffy gave the mission to Stockdale, telling him, "We got Al-Qaeda and UBL up there. Get air power on it." As Stockdale arrived in the vicinity of Tora Bora, he watched the drop of a BLU-82 15,000-pound bomb, affectionately called the Daisy Cutter. The size of a VW van and of similar shape, the bomb was dropped by an MC-130 Talon, extracted by a parachute that gently delivers it to its target. The resulting mushroom cloud resembled an atomic bomb's. Along with the Delta operators, friendly Muj forces, the term Delta used for friendly Afghan forces, and Al-Qaeda fighters in Tora Bora, he was stopped, stunned by the immense singular display of firepower. The bomb was a parting gift to bin Laden from Joe O'Keefe. George, still running the overall battle for the American side, was pushing local warlord General Hazrat Ali to get his forces into the fight and planned to use Delta as the catalyst. Redfly and Ironhead had prepped their shooters and CCT as the sun set and the temperature dropped. They were to move out for a mission, planned to last several days, beginning in the wee hours of the coming morning. With a 100-pound rucksack full of radios and batteries, his Soflam and laser rangefinder prepped for the mission, Stockdale finally lay down, hoping to get a few hours' sleep before they departed, ready for what was to come, his first battle. He'd just nodded off when a Delta operator shook him awake. "They need you." He found his immediate boss, a Delta sniper and recce team leader called Hopper, who told him, "The Muj are saying they've got momentum to break through the AQ lines, but they're stalled out on the mountainside. They need air support." Stockdale nodded. "Got it." "We're going to go fast, go light, and go now." "Got it," repeated the combat controller. In his corner of the CIA's forward-most safe house, an abandoned schoolhouse, he stripped his go-ruck, a mini backpack, from his 100-pound recce ruck. He stuffed in a radio, a few batteries, his ISLID IR pointer, and some water. They were only going to be out for a short time. He rolled up his Soflam, too big for the go-ruck, inside a threadbare wool blanket, and carried it by hand. Their team would be Hopper, Stockdale, an Afghan driver for the Toyota Hilux pickup, and Khan, one of Georgia's CIA men, a former Afghan national and Marine who had been forwarded to Burnson and George by another government agency. Stockdale's instructions were simple. 1. Make sense of the battlefield. And 2. Support the assault to break through enemy lines with air support. The four men climbed into one of the beat-up-looking Hiluxes. Appearances were deceptive. In actuality, they were specially engineered trucks equipped with beefy suspensions and winches and were tuned for high altitude. They were intentionally made to look beat up to avoid attention. As they drove up into the mountains, it quickly became clear that the front lines were close. On the ridge lines above them, they saw Muj recoilless rifle positions. As they wound their way up the single-track road toward the Malawa Valley, they started to receive sporadic Al-Qaeda mortar fire, which didn't seem too bad until they rounded a corner and were confronted by a stuck Russian truck with a twin-barreled 27mm anti-aircraft cannon mounted in the rear. In front of it was an ancient, faded Soviet T-55 tank attempting to pull it out. Hopper, the most experienced operator in the vehicle, immediately recognized the peril and wasted no time. "Let's get out of this truck and into some defilade, now!" he shouted as the men scrambled into an adjacent, deep-channeled ravine. No sooner had they dropped behind some rocks than an 82mm mortar round landed right beside the Hilux, sending shrapnel shrieking over their heads and peppering the pickup. A group of Muj was squatting nearby when another round dropped among them, center mass, killing them all. When the Russian truck was pulled clear, we jumped back in and were on our way, rounds still coming in, targeting us as we drove, recalls Stockdale. At the next intersection, half a kilometer upslope, they found another disabled T-55, this one with two Muj cowering underneath. They skirted the tank and drove to where the road petered out. Their driver, motioning up a ridgeline, stayed in the cab. Clearly, it would be by foot from this point. For Stockdale, it turned into a bit of a circus as they scrambled up a rock scree field in the dark, NVGs as their only advantage, allowing them to make the climb. Above them, we'd encounter one group of Muj, then be passed to another, all of them sort of taking possession of us. It was major confusion. When they finally arrived at the military crest of a ridgeline, the name for the terrain just below summit, which allows for travel without fear of being silhouetted against the sky, and found some vantage over the fighting, he was stunned. The mountainsides and valley in front of him were strewn with the detritus of battle, uprooted trees, splintered and mangled. Joe O'Keefe had done his work well. From their position, Stockdale could see three separate Al-Qaeda Dishka pits chewing up the Muj fighters. He and Hopper prepped his gear so he could get airstrikes onto the closest Dishka. Within minutes, the Admiral had a pair of F-18s inbound from the USS Carl Vinson. With steep terrain and no ability to put a laser right on the Dishka, it was going to have to be an old-school talk-on-to-the-target, Laos style. The art of combat control. It was also Stockdale's first in combat. With the impossibly steep terrain and well-masked positions, any miscommunication or misinterpretation would result in a potentially catastrophic miss. Meanwhile, the evil green arc of Dishka tracers continued to track and destroy the Afghan forces. Hopper watched Stockdale at work as he calmly talked the planes on and destroyed the first Dishka position. When the first Dishka went down, it completely changed the dynamic, because it was really chewing up the forces. The three men and their newest Muj handlers used the destruction to move farther forward onto the battlefield, against the desires of the Afghans, as Stockdale continued to call strikes. Into the day the battle raged. Stockdale recalls, "Those first planes are the only ones I remember," as strike after strike blurred together. Finally, night began to fall, and he received great news. "I'm getting an AC-130. Now it's going to be game on." They were now among the Muj fighting positions, and the Afghans were launching RPGs wildly. "It was ringing the shit out of your bell." Hopper was doing his team leader thing, keeping down the chaos and the Muj under control so I could do my job. He had his soft-flam set up and his ISLID pointer ready for the AC-130. "It was the perfect situation," he recalls. "The gunship is going to be rolling in. Saxon, a British AWACS, is vectoring more air my way." His next set of strike aircraft were B-1s. But before they or the lumbering four-engine angel of death could establish themselves overhead, Clouds descended rapidly in the high mountains, rolling down the mountainsides like avalanches. A storm was coming. The pressure changes were so extreme my ears were popping, he remembers. With the storm inbound, gunship and B-1s were lost, and the men were forced to sit out the freezing weather. The next day broke with new promise and renewed effort. Planes began pouring in, and Stockdale was ready, calling strike after strike in the confined few kilometers of the most contested space in Afghanistan. The battle hit fever pitch. To the Delta operators, "The Admiral is one smooth talker on the radio," stated Greer in his book Kill Bin Laden. "Most important in this business was his willingness to risk everything for his fellow man, an unhealthy but common trait among Air Force combat controllers." By that time, Stockdale, Hopper, and Khan had moved into the middle of the battle space, stunning the Muj fighters, protecting themselves as best they could behind the wall and destroyed structure of a shepherd's hut. At George's schoolhouse, he received an 8-digit grid coordinate on bin Laden's location, putting the terrorist within a 10-meter spot on the earth, the first real fix on the world's most wanted man since the late 1990s. And he gave the information to Redfly, Greer. It was the opportunity all had been waiting for. Across the battlefield, as the other Delta forces tried to maneuver, they listened to the Admiral steadily bringing in the bombers while the distinct sound of gunfire muffled some of his calls, reported Greer. "Just listening raised goosebumps on Jester's arms," Jester being another Delta team leader. The Admiral had just emptied 9 F-18s and a B-1. He had no idea that he was likely the primary reason that bin Laden, the most wanted man in the world, was on the run. His own position was under extreme enemy counterfire, forcing him to make his calls with his head pressed into the battle-mulched earth. An intercept from the enemy confirmed that Father bin Laden is trying to break through the siege line. Listening in with Ironhead, Greer knew the three-man team was in a perilous position. Hopper told Stockdale and Khan they'd done all they could and needed to move back. The enemy had a bead on the exposed American team, and the three battle-formed friends suddenly realized their Muj handlers were missing. They'd abandoned Stockdale, Hopper, and Khan. Only three Muj had remained, and the six of them were trapped, pinned down. In their exposed and lone position in front of the friendly lines, Hopper knew their situation was untenable. They couldn't fight on their own, and to stay would be to wait for death. In the fluid dynamics of a pitched battle, they were no longer forward of the friendly lines, but deep inside Al-Qaeda territory. They were going to have to escape and evade, E&E, death, or even worse, capture. Stockdale, wrapping his softlam back into his hobo blanket, ever the calm voice, made the radio call announcing friendlies were on the run for their lives. Warpath, warpath, warpath. As the three began winding their way through no man's land, friendly fire stretching out over their heads at Al-Qaeda positions, and the enemy returning it, the bombs stopped while Stockdale was off the radio. There was still another CCT, Bill White, in the mountains with the special forces, but since no one knew where the three men were, restarting airstrikes was out of the question. Greer and Ironhead were left with a choice. Continue to pound a fleeing bin Laden, or throw every man they had at recovering the E&E-ing men. Greer's orders had been clear. Kill bin Laden and bring back proof. If the risks and costs of such a task were low, it wouldn't be a Delta mission, but the choice was not made lightly. As Greer pondered his options, Ironhead stated, "Your call, sir. But whatever we do, I don't think we should leave here until we have our boys back." Greer certainly agreed they must eventually recover the men, but UBL just might be killed within the next few hours. He pondered an eternity of a minute before saying, We need to concentrate on recovering our boys first. If things change between now and then, we'll go for Bin Laden too. He would recall that the decision was simultaneously the hardest and easiest of his career. The full force of all available Delta operators, along with controller Sean Gleffy, tried to wind its way through the mortars of Al-Qaeda. There was a very real chance that Al-Qaeda, with hundreds of well-armed and mortar and rocket-supported men, could mount a serious counterattack, especially given that their leader was still somewhere in the caves and cliffs of Tora Bora. Stockdale, Hopper, and Khan, crawling and evading across bomb-cratered earth, managed to make it through 2 kilometers of enemy-held territory over the next 2 hours, gratefully arriving at the abandoned friendly T-55 tank, only to find it was no longer quite so friendly. The Muj of General Ali they'd been supporting and risking their lives for, some of the very men who'd abandoned them, were now managing it as a checkpoint and wanted payment for the Americans to pass through. A furious Khan held back his anger and promised Ali would pay them later. The tribal custom of bribery was common, but a pissed-off Khan neglected to tell Ali that any money was owed. While Khan was negotiating their safe passage, Stockdale took the opportunity to get on the radio and contact Greer, who was elated to learn he hadn't lost any men in the battle yet. Safely back at the schoolhouse, Stockdale and Hopper rearmed and refitted. This time, Delta was going out in force. Augmented by British SBS troopers, the new plan was Delta on each flank with their CCT on the high ground for airstrikes and SBS up the middle. But a ceasefire was under negotiation between Ali and the other warlords and Al-Qaeda, bringing offensive operations to a temporary halt. Greer was under strict orders not to spearhead any assaults on Bin Laden's position, only to facilitate Muj advances and remain close behind. The lone exception was airstrikes. Combat control would remain Delta's only direct shot at killing the terrorist. When operations were resumed, a wily Bin Laden had already safely escaped. Airstrikes and Delta patrols went on for days, with both Stockdale and Gleffy on the radio, but UBL was gone. Of Stockdale's performance, Ironhead would recall, "During the Battle of Tora Bora, he proved his mettle. He and Hopper were separated from the rest of the squadron behind enemy lines. Stockdale took the entire episode in stride and got right back in the fight." Ironhead's sentiments are representative of the strong relationship between CCT and the other best units within Black SOF, particularly Delta and SEAL Team 6. To men like Greer and Ironhead, who would go on to become the sergeant major of the entire Ranger Regiment before retirement, their combat controllers weren't some attachment, some other, but respected members of the unit, as members refer to Delta, with expert skill sets of their own. In Kill Bin Laden, both Stockdale and Gleffy are simply listed as part of the Boys of Delta in the book's list of key characters. Stockdale's view of the events were summarized humbly as, "I basically jumped out of the back of a truck, running from Afghan to Afghan, trying to figure out where the war was." But he discovered that the war went where he did, and wherever that was, he had the power to change the course of history through the handset of his radio. Chapter 7, October 2001. For the 24 STS, 9/11 created a shared sense of purpose and destiny, unlike any in the unit's history. The combat controllers knew there were going to be opportunities to kill terrorists. Some they'd been tracking for years, and others, the perpetrators of the assault on their homeland, no doubt unknowns, who were in the offing for the first time. The unit was the sharpest point of the Special Operations blade. and anticipation of what was to come coursed through the hallways of the building like surges of adrenaline. For John Chapman, the weeks immediately following the attacks were the antithesis of adrenaline-fueled. Being on the survey team was interesting and intellectually stimulating, but it came at an opportunity cost. John was no longer trained and poised for no-notice contingency operations with the most elite Army and Navy units in the military. The trade-off had been worth it. More predictable travel schedules. Time with Val and the girls. Until now. He watched from his computer station as his teammates packed, planned, and then left with the first waves. Some snuck into country even before ODA's 555 and 595. Others into Pakistan to conduct the first combat halo parachute infiltration since the Vietnam War. And there he sat, on the sidelines, again. He was torn between the plans he and Val had for their family's post-military future and his primal urge to avenge the thousands of deaths on American soil. The decision came to him. The unit had largely emptied out with the first wave, and due to needing to keep a portion of the unit on alert in the event of a crisis elsewhere in the world, those not assigned to Delta or SEAL Team 6 were at least getting their chance to be on deck. Still, it wasn't the war. By October, John was in Virginia Beach and attached to SEAL Team 6's Red Team Sniper element, a team he liked, having worked with them before as part of the alert force. The element was led by a humble and wiry SEAL named Britt Slabinski, known as Slab. He was topped by a thatch of sandy brown hair and had a quiet competence that belied a fierce drive to prosecute his mission. John quickly reintegrated into the team and settled into the alert routine. PT in the mornings, afternoons on the rifle range, or executing more complex scenarios at night. Yet it was still mostly a Monday through Friday affair, punctuated by reports filtering back from the front lines as the war unfolded. Tora Bora held everyone's attention, and the SEALs were envious that Delta might get UBL until word came back he'd slipped away. Perhaps Six would finally get their chance at the terrorist leader later, and possibly dispel a bit of the second-class citizen legacy that haunted the unit when compared to Delta Force. Then came word. John, along with Slab's team, would be deploying to Afghanistan in January. What he'd suffered and trained for was at hand, yet it still gave him pause. He wanted so much for his girls, to prepare for life after the military, only a few years away, but he also hadn't lost his desire to join his brothers and finally validate himself in the crucible of combat. In the end, the choice wasn't his. The 2-4 needed him to go, and he was going. Christmas came and went as John enjoyed what time he could with the girls, who'd come to stay with him in his temporary rented Virginia Beach apartment. Their time together was all too short. Then, with the new year, came news that John's paternal grandmother had passed away suddenly on January 4th. John was faced with another choice: deploy, or travel to Michigan to support his family, particularly his dad, Gene. It wasn't a difficult choice. Family came first, and if he could help, that's what you did. It would put the 2-4 in a bind. Someone would have to replace him at the beach, and they were stretched to the breaking point already. But he told his team leader he needed to go back to Bragg. They'd have to send another controller north. Combat controller Mike LaMonica was dispatched to deliver John's replacement and his gear to Virginia Beach and bring John back to Bragg so he could process emergency leave paperwork before catching a flight to Grand Rapids, the closest city to Gene's home. He recalls the drive back, just the two of them. Friends, but not close, as if it were yesterday. It was a clear but cold and windy 4-hour drive, and John did most of the talking, centered on the one thing foremost on his mind. Not his grandmother, not even the war, but his own family. For LaMonica, it was an intimate and largely one-sided conversation. He had a lot on his mind, and I mostly listened, as Chappie, his nickname from high school and throughout CCT, recalled his time with Val at Kadena Air Base, where they lived on a quiet cul-de-sac, sitting with other parents, watching their children play. He spoke of how he and Val approached raising the girls as a team. John contrasted his approach with that of many other combat controllers, who viewed family as something that came second to missions or career, and how it wasn't until Madison and Brianna were born that he recognized the error of that approach. My job now is to serve my country, but there's a greater thing than that. When this war is over, I'm going to dedicate myself to my family, John declared. You could see the profoundness of the words he was sharing, LaMonica remembers. It was intensely personal to him, and it was clear that he and Val loved each other deeply and had discussed those plans as partners. When asked his opinion on John, LaMonica adds, he was rebellious against authority, but that doesn't make him unique in CCT. What really stood out was his humanity and the way he approached family. He paused and thought. It was the last time I ever saw him. After his grandmother's funeral, John returned to Fort Bragg and the 2-4, and learned that Slab's team hadn't deployed after all, not yet, but the combat control position now rightfully belonged to his replacement. John felt like history was repeating itself, and his opportunity to get into the war was somehow slipping away. There was one man who could return John to Slab's team so he could join the war. Lieutenant Colonel Ken Rodriguez was the commander of the 2-4 and had deployed with the first waves in October, spending the next 3 months in theater with his forces. Recalling the early days of the war, he said, "It was groundbreaking and historic for all, but especially the special tactics community. Airfield seizures, multiple static line and halo missions, daring assaults. But back home, the guys were fit to be tied and itching to join the fray." In January of 2002, he was back at the unit and plowing through the backlog of never-ending paperwork that awaited every commander who dared leave the office, when John knocked on his door. They knew each other from their assignments to the 21st STS together, and Rodriguez, happy for the excuse to break from performance reports, ushered him in. As John sat in the chair opposite Rodriguez, he leveled a look at his boss and cut right to the chase. "Colonel, I need to know how soon I can deploy." Rodriguez leaned back in his chair, considering the NCO and the situation. He knew the war wouldn't end anytime soon, but could see the agitation on John's face. Attempting to placate, he replied, "Don't worry, you'll get your opportunity. This is not going to be a short war." John only became more frustrated. For John, if you knew him, that was a flushed face and a certain intensity in the eyes, recalls Rodriguez. It wasn't the answer the combat controller wanted. "RZ," he let off strongly, using Rodriguez's operating initials, "with all due respect, I should have gone last September. It's now been more than 3 months since this war began, and I'm still here with my thumb up my ass. I need to get over there, now." Rodriguez had never seen the normally calm and reserved controller like this. "I don't think we were about to throw down," recalls Rodriguez, but the urgency and strain in Chapman were obvious. As he left Rodriguez's office, his determination was clear. The controller was going back to the beach, and to the war. At the same time, halfway around the world, one of John's 2-4 teammates was having no problems getting into the war. Combat controller Andy Martin was in Oman, the staging base for most of the operations going into Afghanistan. A native of San Diego, he was stocky, with a slight swarthiness to his complexion, rapidly receding dark hair, and a direct personality that was sometimes off-putting to those unfamiliar with him. He'd started his military career in a reserve special forces unit, but joined the Air Force in 1988 expressly to become a combat controller, eventually finding his way to the 2-4. By December, Andy had already racked up 2 combat jumps, one with the 2-4 as they inserted by Halo to survey and run a nighttime desert landing strip, the first since the Iranian rescue attempt at Desert One decades earlier, and another was SEAL Team 6. He had two more missions planned with other units when one of the 2-4 Squadron operations officers informed him, "You're going to come back and link up with the SEAL Team 6 Red Team snipers." To Andy Martin, a man who wanted to hunt down and kill terrorists, "It's what I'd waited my entire life for, because I knew the Red Team snipers really well, and those guys were going to get it on." His early missions in the war were good, but he'd yet to kill a terrorist. The first Gulf War was fun, but there was no killing, and to Andy Martin, that was one thing he wanted to do before he died. And he knew the SEALs would see it the same way. Little did he know how apropos the axiom, "Be careful what you wish for," would be to his desires. After a long flight home and a short Christmas with his family, he headed to Virginia Beach to meet up with the SEALs and Chapman. In Fayetteville, John was home after receiving confirmation that he was to join up with Andy and the two of them would deploy with Slab's team. He had only days left to spend with the three ladies in his life, so between preparing for war at work and packing at home, he made the most of them. John and Val treated his deployment as nothing new. "I knew he was going on a mission," Valerie recalls matter-of-factly, "but he didn't give me any details. We were both used to it." On his final morning at home, as he kissed Madison and Brianna goodbye, he spotted two of their pink hair ties. He picked them up, gently rubbing them between his calloused fingers, and tucked them into his breast pocket, tiny mementos to remind him of his little loves. Valerie drove him to the JSOC compound, dropping him at the gate. With a quick kiss and an, "I'm out," he smiled and waved as he walked past JSOC's tight security. Her in-home nursing assignments were waiting, so she turned the car around and drove off. They were so used to him coming and going, and the hazards of CCT at the 2-4. "It was just business as usual for us. I didn't realize it was the last time I was going to see him." At SEAL Team 6 in the Red Team Sniper section, it was anything but business as usual. Most of the men had yet to deploy, none having tasted battle in the manner they desired, to kill the terrorists responsible for 9/11 and their supporters, particularly the Taliban. The two CCT completed the team, giving them an even dozen men for the deployment. For John, his desire to join the mission was tempered by the rust that had formed on his counter-terrorist skill sets. He'd been on the survey team for 2 years, with only periodic combat training. Compounding the issue was his age. He was older, now approaching 37, than almost every other shooter on the team, and was worried about his ability to keep up. It concerned him enough that he confided in Slab, who reassured him, "Don't worry, you'll do fine." But he also was conflicted by something else. As much as he needed this mission to validate his career, having two little girls at home who adored him had changed his perspective. Life was not about killing, except at the 2-4 and SEAL Team 6 when you're getting ready to go to war. The day finally came in late January. All their gear had been staged and transported to Naval Air Station Oceana to meet their waiting C-17s. Like Viking longboats of 1,000 years before, these aircraft's purpose was to ferry them across the Atlantic to a savage land and battle. The men gathered behind the sniper shop inside SEAL Team 6's compound. They were waiting, all of them dressed in anonymous gray Air Force flight suits, with small backpacks for the long flight. The late afternoon was cool but not cold enough for jackets, and there was only small talk among the team. As the blue Navy buses pulled up to take them to the plane, Slab gathered his men around him. "Look," he said, and all eyes turned to him, sensing he had something more than flight movement schedules on his mind. "Things are going to happen on this trip. Number one, every one of you is going to kill somebody. Number two, you're all coming back alive." For Andy Martin, anxious to get his first kill. It was the pre-game speech he'd waited for. "Fuck yeah," was his only thought. He scanned the men around him, some nodding, others wearing stoic looks, but all were in agreement. "Fuck yeah." Until his eyes fell on John, his expression a cross between realization and dismay. "I think it was the first time the gravity of the situation hit him," he recalls. "To be told something like that by somebody you respect as a leader isn't to be taken lightly." Adds Andy, "When you're out of the game for a while, there's a cognitive dissonance of how things are, what we do. It's not that he wasn't capable, I just think it hit him pretty hard in the respect that it was game on." The two men let the moment pass and never spoke of it. The bus doors opened, and the team climbed aboard, leaving America for their war. Chapter 8, February 2002. When the SEALs and the two controllers landed in Afghanistan, along with an entire SEAL Team 6 command and control force structure, it was clear Bagram Airfield was no longer the battleground it had been just 2 months before. Transformed by the relentless might of the U.S. military's logistical magicians, with what to the impoverished Afghans seemed like endless supplies and equipment, not to mention ceaseless airplanes, it now resembled a major commercial airport of the developed world. The only real signs one was in Afghanistan were the desolate, snow-capped mountains that surrounded the base, the bland, low-slung architecture of the city, and the February winds rushing down from the Hindu Kush, slicing through heavy clothing and singeing exposed skin, promising frigid combat for the men offloading the C-17s fresh from Virginia Beach. Operations were still ramping up in-country, and SEAL Team 6 wasted no time getting in on the action. The snipers, along with Andy and John, moved into a tent city made of heavy vinyl with large heating and air conditioning units plugged into the sides to combat the extreme temperatures. John stayed with Slab, while Andy was assigned to the number 2 enlisted sniper leader, a SEAL known as Goody. Inside, the men made the most of their personal space. A cot and crates for storing kits, or, for some lucky ones, unfinished pine shelves crafted from crates. Tent City living was old hat to the SEALs and controllers, and little note was made about the living quarters. They were there to hunt men. They soon planned their first safari, for the elusive Taliban founder, Mullah Omar, codename Objective Bear, a one-eyed former Mujahideen and the de facto head of Afghanistan from the time of the Taliban's rise in the mid-90s until the American invasion displaced him. He was rumored to be in the remote mountains of the Bamiyan province, northwest of Kabul, home of the giant cliff-carved Buddhas that would eventually be destroyed by Taliban forces. Intelligence from the CIA indicated he was holed up in a village, moving from one secure location to another. The planned mission was to catch him in transit between his safe houses, using an 80-man local partisan force for security and guidance through the mountainous terrain. For the operation, a 6-man British Special Boat Service unit was to accompany the SEALs and CCT. The mission's call sign was Mako 30, Red Sniper's Standard. On February 15th, the 19 Americans and Brits climbed aboard 3 160th MH-47s for the 100-mile flight to Bamiyan. Slab and John, with a handful of SEALs, were on Chalk 1, the first helicopter. The Brits, Chalk 2, and Andy and Goody on the last Chalk. A Special Tactics Combat Search and Rescue, CSAR, team was aboard Andy's helicopter. Led by a PJ named Carrie Miller, it had CCT Gabe Brown as its airstrike and coordination wizard. The CSAR was not part of the mission. They were only there in the unlikely event of an aircraft crash or a call for medevac by other SOFs operating that evening. Carrie Miller and Gabe Brown could not have known their destinies would converge with John Chapman again on a mountain summit, the name of which none of them had yet heard uttered. Take Her Gar. On the LZ in the dark, the men quickly unloaded and stepped onto an anonymous valley floor high in the mountains next to a small mud hut village. When the helicopters had departed, Slab and the SBS leader met with the local partisan leaders and discussed the situation. One thing was certain. The Afghans were not going to lead the Americans anywhere in the dark. We ended up in a defensive posture, staying in a goat pen, waiting for sunrise so we could wrangle the partisan force, recalls Andy. The sunrise brought a surprise. The Afghan partisans had brought donkeys to carry supplies and the Americans' rucksacks, because they were going to walk 22 kilometers to a position above the village where they claimed Omar was coordinating the Taliban's campaign. Andy and John looked dubiously at the donkeys. According to Andy, they looked like German shepherds. They were that small. And we were laughing because we're thinking, yeah, right, these things are going to die under the loads we got. Duly loaded by the expert Afghan mule wranglers, the 100-man and donkey force set off for the distant target, trudging higher into the mountains on a narrow single-track footpath. Continues Andy, well, within about half an hour, those little donkey bastards were out of sight ahead of us. The men watched with varying degrees of dismay as they lost control and sight of their ammo, survival gear, and batteries. The long day led into night as the force moved into assault position on ridgelines towering above another nondescript and nameless village, Omar's reported readout. Unfortunately, the weather had moved back in, closing down visibility as darkness descended upon them. The weather drops to 00 visibility, absolute dog shit for airplanes, remembers Andy. The partisans were telling Slab and the Brit leader that Omar was definitely in the village, but in the freezing mountain storm, the Afghans weren't willing to move forward, and the Allies agreed to retreat to another nearby village and wait out the inclement weather. Through their interpreter and the partisans, each of the Mako 30 elements was lodged with a separate local family, involuntarily. John and Slab went to one with a handful of SEALs, the Brits a second, and Andy with more SEALs to a third. They'd never seen a Westerner before, and the only other foreigners they'd seen were Soviet troops. They were terrified, recalls Andy. Who could blame them? The Americans, vigilant to the very real possibility of an ambush and suspicious of their reluctant hosts, sent the men of the families out but kept watch on them. The partisans saw an opportunity and tried to push the women and children out as well, in order to stay inside where there was warmth. The heat source was minimal, no bigger than a coffee can, but heat nonetheless. When John saw what was happening, he stepped in. No way, we are not putting women and children out in the cold. They stay, you go, he directed through the interpreter. Pashtun hospitality demanded they feed and care for the dangerous-looking and heavily armed outsiders, so the family slaughtered goats and chickens, feeding the Americans significant portions of their winter stores. In return, Goody, Andy's SEAL team leader, tried to pay them in U.S. dollars, but the family refused to accept the cash, even though they understood the value of American currency. The villagers slowly came to realize that the men were no threat and cautiously accepted them, in large part because of John's good nature. Slab would later state, John's demeanor put them at ease, and I fully believe that helped keep us safe. In John and Slab's house, the parents had two young boys and a tiny one-year-old daughter, a sun-darkened beauty with huge chocolate-colored eyes, darkly arched eyebrows, and a disarming smile. As Slab got on his Toughbook laptop to communicate with SEAL Team 6 HQ in Bagram, John was reminded of his own daughters, Madison and Brianna, who weren't that much older, and formed an instant connection. Cognizant of how much they were putting these modest people out, John was as respectful and helpful as he could be, Not that the others weren't, but John was purposeful about it. On one of the nights, while they were waiting for the storm to pass, the little girl's mother showed how much John had won her over when she placed her daughter in his lap. Realizing the significance of the moment, a rarity given the culture in which no male outside of the family is allowed to touch a female, he asked Slab to retrieve his disposable camera and snap a shot. The resulting black-and-white photo captures the juxtaposition of the warrior and the man, a kind soul in a foreign land, there to do a rough job, but whose love of family and children transcended fear and hostility. To freeze frame a poignant moment when two humans silently bonded across language and culture. John's kind eyes, gazing directly into the camera, belie the warrior beneath. For 2 days, the team remained ensconced in Afghan hospitality, while the partisan force held the possibility of ambush at bay. Finally, the force moved silently into position above the suspected Mullah Omar refuge. The partisans wanted the Americans to take the village down, yet something seemed off. Slab and Goody conferred, and as Andy observed, "We need to rethink this." In the village below, there were mostly women and children going about their day. No combat power whatsoever, and no sign of Omar. Slab turned to his combat controllers. "Can you order up a show of force?" He wanted something that would shake the village and possibly the truth out of the situation they and the locals found themselves in. Andy got on the net and contacted Kmart, the Combined Forces Air Component Commander, CFAC, in charge of air power in theater, and explained what he wanted. Kmart, so named for convenient one-stop shopping, had just the item. A B-1 bomber coming off another mission and heading home. "Perfect," declared the controller. "He called me 50 miles out and inbound at high Mach down through the valley," recalls the controller. Andy gave the pilot an entry and exit point above the unsuspecting village and cleared him for the very high-speed pass. "He comes down through the valley, maybe 700 feet above the ground, and he's got this air cone coming off of him that you only see in pictures," he recalls of the plane. "As it passed, it pulled up and was already firing back to altitude like a bullet. When the shockwave hit us, it sounded and felt like 10 J-dams going off all at once." Unsurprisingly, the town's residents poured from their huts, stunned by the display, and sent two representatives to meet with the Americans and Brits. Through the interpreter, Slab, overall in command of the mission, realized that what they'd walked into wasn't the potential hiding place of the number one Taliban target, but a village-on-village, Afghan-style Hatfields versus McCoys feud. Omar had been there, some parties claimed, but had long since departed. The partisan force provided to Mako 3-0 saw the opportunity to settle a decade-long dispute. During discussions, which took hours to sort out, Andy continued his show of force with more aircraft passes until Slab finally called a halt to the ear-shattering displays. With no Omar, nor even any real indication that he was ever actually there, "We left after the show of force. A dry hole," Andy recalls of the wasted mission. John called back for exfil, and a lone MH-47 returned to retrieve them. Recognizing the burden they'd placed on the small village, he added a request to accompany the extraction helicopter. As the Hilo hovered into position on the steep mountainside, its nose and blades hanging out over the precipitous space and its ramp dropped to retrieve the men, a cargo pallet was dragged onto the mountain by the team. Strapped securely to the top of the plywood was cooking oil, coal, stoves, and dry goods such as peanut butter and sugar for the village who'd taken them in. John, on his own initiative, had requested the provisions as a token for the family and the little girl who'd stolen his heart. It was a small gesture in a large war, Perhaps it made no real difference in a country shattered by decades of conflict, but it mattered to the combat controller. With nothing to show for their efforts but potential misuse of American and British military might and a bit of goodwill, the men clambered aboard and disappeared into the dark. The CCT aspects of the mission, driven primarily by Andy, had also been a bust for John. He hoped his next mission would provide greater opportunity to demonstrate his value and capabilities. Part 2. Anaconda. Chapter 9. January 16, 2002. Pete Blaber took in his surroundings as he sat back in a worn, overstuffed chair in an upstairs meeting room inside a hotel in downtown Kabul. The hotel was an Afghan government-owned enterprise, but had not conducted business as a publicly available lodging in many years. Prior to the American invasion, it was used by the Taliban for troop R&R, and during the Soviet campaign, the Russians had utilized it for similar purposes. Having rented the entire facility, the CIA was now sole proprietor of the square plug of a building that was surrounded by a 10-foot wall topped with concertina wire. The agency used it to hold sway over most U.S. activities taking place in-country at this stage of the war. Blaber, a 6'2" Delta Force lieutenant colonel with a passing resemblance to Kevin Costner, sported thick black hair and preferred a well-trimmed goatee to the standard operator beard. Outfitted in cargo pants, long-sleeve shirt, and Afghan scarf, he blended comfortably into CIA space. He'd conducted previous clandestine operations in the Balkans in close collaboration with the agency and was already on his second tour in Afghanistan. The dusty room was furnished with large threadbare chairs, a couch, and traditional locally made rugs of muted greens and reds. The curtains were drawn, save a slim ray of light illuminating the interior, giving it the appearance of a 19th-century British gentleman's club that had seen better days. Inside, representatives from the special operations community gathered around the CIA's deputy chief of station, a man named John, who organized the Daily Select Brain Trust. Blaber and his operations officer, Jimmy Reese, were the only Delta Force leaders present. The other key leader in the room was Lieutenant Colonel Chris Haas, a giant man with a jovial disposition who was the Special Forces Battalion commander for all of eastern Afghanistan. The day's meeting was focused on a shared problem: what to do next. The Taliban's abandonment of the capital in November of the previous year allowed the agency and SOF to occupy Kabul without a fight, a seemingly significant and early victory for the Americans. But the Taliban and their often imperious purse-string-holding Arabian overseers hadn't truly been defeated, merely displaced. Even Tora Bora, Delta and Combat Control's shining opportunity to dispatch bin Laden, was another example of squeezing the enemy like a balloon, only to have it effuse to either side of the American fist. So the question remained, where the hell were they? The gathering was more a brainstorming session than a structured briefing, with the three principals, Blaber, Haas, and John, agreeing to informal information sharing and collaboration. No generals or formal chains of command were involved, only key leaders on the front lines. Blaber described the fusion. The CIA provided the ability to produce and process intelligence, special forces teams would train and equip the Afghans, and Blaber's men would operationalize the entire effort by conducting on-the-ground reconnaissance to find and destroy the enemy. The meeting broke up when Haas announced he had an obligation at his own compound. After he departed, the men stood, and John, whom Blaber described as sporting a Jesus hairdo and beard, held the Delta operator back. The spy walked to the curtains and drew them fully closed. We're getting a lot of reports that Al-Qaeda forces are regrouping in an area in the mountains between Gardez and Khoust, he said, leveling an even gaze at Blaber. What's it called?
Shahi Khat.
The name didn't register with the Delta operator, but given that John had whispered the word, even inside his own secure space, Blaber gave it the appropriate gravity and whispered back,
Can you spell that?
S-H-A-H-I-K-H-O-T, he said quietly as they parted. Blaber grabbed Jimmy, and the two stepped into a driving blizzard outside the compound as the former contemplated the implications of John's revelation. Pete Blaber was a non-parochial and seasoned veteran of Delta Force. After serving as a ranger, he'd joined the unit, always referred to with a capital U by its members, in 1991, and, since then, had climbed the very narrow pyramid that existed for officers to command Delta's B Squadron. Along the way, he'd conducted manhunts in the Balkans and executed clandestine operations in a handful of other countries. After B Squadron, he had commanded a smaller element inside Delta focused exclusively on clandestine and low-visibility capabilities. So when it came time for Task Force 11 to select a leader for fusing the CIA and Special Forces, he was the natural, if reluctant, choice. Task Force 11, or TF-11, was the higher headquarters for an agglomeration of all black special operations in-country, including Delta, SEAL Team 6, and a few others. For Major General Del Daly and Brigadier General Greg Trebone, the commanders of TF-11, Blaber presented an opportunity as well as a challenge. His credentials weren't in question. It was his personality. In addition to his well-known disdain for rigid military hierarchy, structure, and planning methodology,